I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse today, everyone. My guest is an author and teacher, and his interests and studies merge at some very fascinating intersections that include theology, philosophy, psychoanalysis, and politics. His name is Tad DeLay, and thank you so much, Tad, for being on the program today.
It's great to be here.
I should also mention, too, that he has the same last name as me, but we are not related, at least not that we know of. And we were going to try to think of some hijinks to fool you or something, but didn't get around to that. So you can spread vicious rumors if you'd like, but they will be, of course, always untrue. And today we're going to be talking about a little bit about Tad's upcoming book that is based on his original book, that's dissertation related, I believe. It's based on your dissertation called The God is Unconscious?
Yeah, actually, my dissertation will be my third book.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm putting out two beforehand, but getting an early start on the publishing, I guess.
That's great. And yeah. I have read God is Unconscious, and there were so many great concepts in there, but the first thing I thought of was, this is really tough sledding. I hope he makes this easier to understand in a non-scholarly way, because it's, for people who haven't read Jacques Lacan and Sigmund Freud, it would be tough. But the manuscript in its rough form that I've read has a lot of really, really powerful concepts, and I was very excited to dig into them a little bit and whet people's appetites for what's to come.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm really excited about it. First thing I should say is, like, this material is really personal to me, and it's been extremely helpful for me to think through on my own. And so it's not psychoanalysis is a very popular topic in philosophy and religious studies, but it's been just so incredibly personally helpful to me that I ended up writing a book on it. And people have never heard of Jacques Lacan, one of the things that they might not know is he is widely regarded as one of the most difficult people ever to read. So even a book that tries to put him into sort of more accessible language like God is Unconscious did is still really difficult. And that was like the I got such positive feedback about God is Unconscious, but the persistent criticism was that it was just still too difficult. Mm. And I'm of the mind that religious studies is kind of one of these unique fields in that it really nothing that we do matters that much if we can't translate it into language that people can understand. You know, like there's a sense in which mathematics and sciences and so many other fields, even literature, would matter even if people didn't have an appreciation for it. They just sort of matter for their own sake. But I don't view religion that way, and I think that we who do scholarship in religion have a very serious responsibility to communicate that language to people who don't have years and years on end to just study this full time. So that's where the second book came from. Is I wanted to hit a lot of the Freudian slip there. I wanted to hit a lot of the same themes, but put it in a more accessible format. And there's some new ideas in there. But yeah, I'm hoping it's helpful to people.
Now, did you read Lacan in French or did you read it in English?
My French is limited, so I've read some in French, and there's more than half the material that he ever put out is in French. So, he's died in 1981, and so it's sort of every year or two there's a new seminar that comes out in translation. So, so that'll probably continue. He'll probably continue to have new material coming out for the rest of my career. So some of that's inaccessible, and so I can read some of it, but not a whole lot.
Yeah, I would think that he would be confusing even in French, but then with a translation, it adds a second layer of difficulty, perhaps, because someone has to try to figure out best words to use and things. But one of the concepts about the big other, and maybe we should even first say the book God is Unconscious is one of those titles that can be super confusing if you're not understanding kind of what is meant by unconscious, and the big other kind of figures into that. So it would be interesting for you to unpack or explain a little bit in summary of what you mean in your title of the first book.
Okay. Well, so that phrase, "God is unconscious," is it's from this particular point in one of his seminars, this 11th seminar that's seen as this big turning point. And he makes this point. He's always making this point that even as a sort of atheist, grew up in sort of the Catholic family, but very much an atheist, and he's speaking to primarily atheists, although as time goes on, there starts to be more priests that are filtering into his seminars. And he's always got this antagonistic relationship to the atheist, in a sense, where he's saying, you seem to think that you can just get rid of God and that's going to solve something, but if there's anything that neurotics prove to us every day, is that if there is no God, nothing is possible anymore. And it's a play on some themes that Dostoevsky and some others come up with. So what he's trying to say is that we as human beings seem to need some sort of other to authorize what we're doing, right? Like, you never really know that you've made a right decision in a career or in a relationship or anything else until someone else that you really trust is also saying, hey, mm-hmm. yeah, like, I agree with that position or whatever. Mm-hmm. So we are always in this relationship to others that is authorizing or negating certain decisions that we have. And if there was that voice that just completely removed itself, then you're not sure of yourself at all anymore. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's this classic phrase that if there was no God, then anything would be possible. And we can make any decision we wanted without restraint. And Lacan is saying, no, the opposite is true. If there was no God authorizing your actions, nothing would be possible anymore. You would absolutely cease motion. You would second guess everything that you did. So whether you call it God, or whether you call it a big other, or whether you call it some ideology or relationship or whatever else, you're always going to be looking for that authorization, that sort of proxy for the security that you wish you could have, right? So so in his 11th seminar, he has this phrase where he says, you know, essentially, there's this idea that God is ineffable, but that's not quite so. Like, we can speak of gods all day long, but what must remain ineffable is the void that the gods are covering over. So the exact quote is, the true formula for atheism is not God is dead, like Nietzsche. The true formula for atheism is God is unconscious. That is to say, simply removing gods doesn't do as much as you might think it does. People are still going to shift to the next thing that they think they can trust in, which might be better, but it still doesn't remove that essential dynamic that we try to give authority over our lives to something else. And that's just a human thing to do. That's not like a good or bad. That's the way that we are as people.
Mm-hmm. It's an observation that you don't stop being human because you remove this referential factor that you're, you know, if you decide, okay, I'm going to give up this religion or this father figure, spouse, or someone who's a reference point in your life, you don't actually get rid of them. You get really disoriented and then you pick some other reference point probably then. Mm.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, so there is a condition that afflicts right around 1% or maybe a little less of us that doesn't have a big other, except that the psychoanalysts would call that psychosis, right? So, like, if somebody is, for instance, experiencing paranoia or certain types of delusions where they're talking to someone else in public, right? So that's, like, a very common one. Like, in the sense that they're carrying on a full conversation with an imaginary partner, it's not that person considers themselves free and liberated from the demand not to talk to yourself in public. It's that they literally just don't experience that part of reality that's socially ingrained into the rest of us, right? So there is such a thing as somebody who doesn't have a big other, but it has problems attached to it too, like limits to how much they can be ingrained into the social complex.
Be a little okay. You went to the deep end of the pool, so I have to get my water wings out for a second, because. Okay, so when you're saying psychosis, that person is, are they doing the same thing? They're doing the same thing as everybody else, except for that it isn't shared by, their belief isn't shared by anybody else. It isn't, I might be saying this completely wrong. I'm just trying to interpret what you're saying. Right. I have a low horsepower mind, but like really high RPM. So I'm going like a mile a minute here. So it's like, maybe you can maybe you can unpack that a little bit. So somebody with psychosis is doing the same sort of things that other people are doing, but nobody can verify that same other that they are because it's delusional.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense. So like, and I guess I should clarify just to make sure everyone knows, I'm not a trained psychologist or even a trained psychoanalyst. So I've studied this material a lot, but I'm trained as a philosopher and a theologian, not a psychoanalyst. So I'm coming at this the best I can from the materials I've read. There's a sense in which at some point in our past, we were all essentially what we would call today psychotic, in a sense that we did not have any sorts of rules regulating behavior. Killed as we saw fit. We were nice to people in as much as it would help us. And at some point in our past, two hominids locked eyes and realized that they couldn't kill each other over, access to resources or something like that. And then you start to have these hunter-gatherer societies that are very egalitarian, very cooperative. And that's the avenue that natural selection chose to have us pass our genes along, right? But once you get to that point where you start to have certain taboos and laws, don't steal, don't kill, don't have incest, you know, don't burn down everything you have, these types of things, right? Like once you start to have these taboos, we enter a state of what a psychoanalyst would call sort of a collective neurosis, right? So we're all starting to not just judge each other directly, but have a sense that there is some concept of the good or the right or the gods, that if I do something cheating my neighbor, all of a sudden the big other is looking down from heaven judging me as well. So society is only possible in as much as we have this sort of very latent concept of a big other judging us. These concepts of shared rules, and what the psychosis is essentially is it's a failure of those social rules to regulate normal day-to-day behavior.
Oh,
right. And there's all sorts of hereditary and actual biological factors as well. But if you're talking purely at the abstract level, trying to use this as a theory that you can analyze religion and politics and society, then it would be just as true to say that psychosis is the failure of these symbolic shared structures to regulate individual behavior. Right. So psychosis is in that sense lends itself to more antisocial behavior, not because it's wrong, but just because it doesn't fit into the whole. And so it becomes stigmatized, right? And that is way more wading into the deep end than I usually so I hope that makes some sense, but if we need to shift around, that's totally fine too.
Yeah, and it's interesting about how, like, we don't tend to think that way. It's on automatic. And as I was reading The Cynic and the Fool, which you can define those terms, cynic and fool, because they're on the surface, those are also words that sort of mean other things as you tease them out in the book.
Right.
But as we're thinking in those terms, a lot of those things, until you read them, until you're explaining them, we're not thinking that there is a big other. You know, we're just going along and we're doing things and we're thinking about consequences perhaps, but we're not thinking of a big other until we're you shine that mirror, and then we're saying, "Oh yeah, of course there's a big other. Of course there's something going on." I'm like, for me, I'm very guilt prone, and I have really, really powerful authority figures in my life. So when I see a cop, I do freak out. I do like grab the steering wheel super hard, and of course I'm going under the speed limit. The big other is super present in my life, and I don't think there's anything I can do to like scratch that out. It's just going to be completely impossible for me, no matter where I go in my beliefs or embracing them or not, you know? So it's really interesting. So when you said big other, and I'm reading and I'm going like, whoa, because I realize how pervasive that is. And I think other people, as they read that, that'll be a very sharp point where they go, oh, I see that. I really see that.
Right. Yeah. In Freud, even like in a few places, he says kind of essentially people come into analysis thinking that they want to be well. But the awkward thing is that people are only engaging in repetitive behaviors that don't work, like guilt, because you enjoy the certainty in a sense, right? Mm-hmm. Like you actually kind of enjoy being ill. So guilt is like, if you feel condemned, then there's no question of whether you're condemned or not. Like that's something you can know for sure. Or if you feel like you should have done something and you definitely didn't do it and now you're in the wrong, well, now you know for sure that you were in the wrong. Like you don't have to question that anymore. So there's a sense in which we get some sort of pleasure from feeling guilty because, okay, well, now I know where I stand in relation to God or in relation to this person that I wronged. I don't have to wonder about it anymore. It's just easier to consider myself ill. But I use a story in the book, maybe this will help, because a lot of people, this is probably the story that gets quoted back to me most often as being like a helpful way to think about what is a big other, is I tell the story where, let's say you have this kid that grows up doing everything to please her parents. In some way or another, everything is done. Like, so all kids do certain things to please their parents. But let's just take for granted that everything she does is pretty much tied to this, right? So she's dating the right people. She's a team player. Everyone loves her. Obedient, respectful, goes to the right school, graduates, marries the right person, starts all of this in some way, let's just say, is tied to wanting that parent's approval, right? And then let's say that one day she gets the tragic phone call that says, I'm so sorry, but your parents were traveling late at night and they never saw the drunk driver on the opposite side of the road and they're gone, right? So what immediately happens at that point, right? There's intense trauma. Her relationship begins to fray. She cannot concentrate. She's having all sorts of anxieties about what she can and can't do in relation to her family. Is she going to be a good mother? All of this. But if she's been doing things to try to please her parents, then that part of her behavior is probably not going to change that much, in a sense. So let's say that she goes into, once her relationships have started to fray, when she's starting to have these habits that are becoming addiction, she goes into the psychoanalyst office, and she's talking about the trauma that led up to this point. If the psychoanalyst understands that, if he makes the connection that she is doing this in order to please her parents, if she's always lived to please her parents in some way, then the psychoanalyst does not need to tell her that her parents are dead and therefore she's free and she can live any way that she wants now, right? Because that's not how people work, right? She does not need to be told that her parents are dead. The parents need to be told that they're dead, right? In a sense, like she still, if she's been doing things to try to please the big other, then that big other is still there regardless of whether or not the figures in the world that she's represented that position with are still there or not, right? Like she's still going, now her language will change, and that's probably the important part that I should always emphasize, is like her language will change from I hope my parents are proud of me to I hope my parents would have been proud of me, or I hope my parents are looking down from heaven proud of me, but the parents still need to be proud of her, right? So her behavior sort of continues on in that same way, and that's what we do in religion a lot of times, right? Like we say, okay, this idea of God as this eternal guilt-ridden punisher character doesn't work for me, so I'm going to maybe rearticulate what I think about atonement or literalism or some sort of fundamentalist idea or something like that, right? But then we keep all the same, like we keep the same, like God is there to judge me or to authorize behaviors, or maybe instead of authorizing right, like self-righteousness, now he's authorizing justice or something like that. Like, so we change the language around, but we want to keep that essential relationship of trying to please the big other figure in place. And that's part of what it means to say, like, the true formula for atheism would not be God is dead, but God is unconscious, right? Like, it's not that people need to, the girl doesn't need to realize her parents are dead. Like, she already knows that. That's not a mystery to her. Like, she needs to realize that the parents were always in her head to begin with. The thing that she was trying to please was always there inside of her. And facts of the matter don't necessarily have that much to do with how we change behaviors.
And then the part about, as you said, that the psychoanalyst would give her a new signifier. And that piece, or I don't know if that has to do with placeholders or not, that might be a separate issue, but that you don't just rip away a signifier for a person like that, or you don't just take that away because that doesn't lead to anything positive, just maybe more anxiety. Maybe you can...
Yeah, sure. I mean, that can be a little more nebulous, but yeah, I think in a sense, anybody who goes to a psychoanalyst or really any sort of psychotherapist, regardless of what kind of theoretical orientation they're coming at, the reason you go to that is because you have identities, signifiers that aren't working in your life, right? Like, so you might go to therapy thinking, well, one of my signifiers is incredibly consistent in all I do, or very self-righteous, or, you know, mother, or whatever else. You're going to have these signifiers, these names that work for you. And part of the reason you're in analysis is that you've been trying to please these signifiers, trying to please these things that you think the big other wants from you, and those aren't working for you anymore. So in, you know, under conditions of capitalism, we are all, in a sense, capitalist first, and then all of our other identities for second, right? With the exception of perhaps race might be as big of a signifier as a capitalist subject, right? And then sort of, I don't know, you know, we're in a presidential election cycle. So like this comes up regularly. I won't go too much into politics here, but, you know, you'll have candidates saying, you know, I'm an American first or in a Christian second, or usually the reverse, right? Because if you're trying to identify with Christians, you're supposed to say, I am a Christian first, then a husband, then a parent, then a Republican or Democrat, and then an American or whatever, you know, or whatever, right? Like you sort of have like this whole rank that you're supposed to preserve. And part of what an analyst is supposed to do is say, okay, well, part of the problem that you have either in your life or in your society is that you have these mismatched signifiers that you're trying to please in different ways, and those aren't working for you. So what does it mean to instead of think of yourself as somebody who is supposed to be a good child, what does it mean to start thinking of yourself as somebody with desires that are simply going to be different than your parents, or you know, something like that? Like, what? How are these signifiers not working for you? How are you trying to enclose yourself off and think of yourself in boxes that don't work, right? So you know, this is one of the phrases I like is that like Lacan says, basically psychoanalysis is just interested in whatever doesn't work, right? That's the only focus. Like we're only interested in things that don't work, because what doesn't work is what people are enjoying the most.
That's kind of one of those sad commentaries. And so maybe you can go into a little bit of what the title of your upcoming book, The Cynic and the Fool, it's binary how you set it up, but obviously within the content of the book, you don't set it up as entirely binary. There's more of a spectrum. Yeah. It's more nuanced than that. And I, as I was reading through, I was like, oh, you know, you read through these things and you're like, oh my gosh, which one am I? You know, you're wondering, you know, but they're really, it's very fascinating how it's laid out. And I think that a lot of people are going to get a lot from this, especially as you read it and you see sort of the template, if you will, kind of laid out in different settings, or whether you've grown up with one thing or the other, and how you see things played out as, you know, people in power or people in your life have played one role or the other. But maybe you can kind of extrapolate some of that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, great. Yeah. Yeah. So this is the whole idea of framing it sort of as a binary cynic or fool is I'm still not completely comfortable with that, because as you say, it sort of lends to the idea that you could be just one or the other. Mm-hmm. And usually where there's a binary, there's a fiction underlying that binary that like it doesn't really work that way. Right. And it doesn't. And that's so like I want to be very clear that like the title of my book doesn't completely work for that reason. Right. Nobody is just a cynic or just a fool. And then complicating things more, I'm using them slightly different than they're often not terribly different. Mm-hmm. But by cynic, there's a sense in which when you call someone a cynic, sometimes you mean that they're very skeptical, that they doubt everyone's motives, and that's sort of the more common usage. But then there's this other usage that I'm sort of more identifying with, that people will say, like in the sense of a politician as being cynical, right? So which is more like nihilism, right? Like, so they don't really care what their policy is going to do or their rhetoric is going to do. They're just saying it because they know that that's what people want to hear, and it's a good means to an end, right? So that's sort of that's the way we use the term cynical in sort of theory world, right? So we use it that term. And then as far as fool, I don't quite mean so much like stupid. Mm-hmm. I mean it more in the sense of like the fool is the one who wishes that they could believe directly in something, whereas the cynic is the one that wants to use belief as a means to an end. So the fool is the one that is just primed to believe that when their pastor or community leader or whatever says something, that's really the way that the world works, right? And that pastor has no ulterior motives, right? So or whatever. So I'm talking about this as a third complicating thing. Is that, so we discussed like the complicating thing of like having a binary in the first place, and mm-hmm. the second of like I'm using these terms kind of oddly. Mm-hmm. The third complicating thing is that there is such a tendency, I think, in society today to say that whenever you question someone's motives and mm-hmm. call them cynical or nihilistic, that says just a lot about you and nothing actually helpful in the world, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's a very common response, and I resonate with that somewhat. But I think that we are in a place in society where it's very important to sometimes just look at the world around you and understand that not everyone sees the world the same way that you do. And if somebody is consistently showing you that they don't believe things all that much or don't take this idea that you hold so dear to be the same thing you do, there is the possibility that someone is just posturing or just using something as a means to an end.
Yeah.
And I would wager that is far more true the higher up the chain of power you go.
Right.
There's just all sorts of institutional pressures to posture a certain way and in that sense be sort of more of the cynical character. So I don't want to say that all leaders or all pastors or all politicians or all civic activists or anything like that are cynical. Not at all.
Right.
But I am saying that I think if we want to sort of move forward through some of the most pressing matters today, we do need to think about the differences in motives in play, different ways that those manifest, and that can lead to naming things that are right in front of us that need to be named and thought about so that we can have a more hopeful road ahead.
I know when I was reading it, I think I could be wrong, but I think the terms, you could even use the terms instead of cynic, you could say manipulator, instead of fool, you could say believer almost. But just kind of my take on it.
Yeah.
Not exactly. It isn't exactly analogous, but it's similar. And so when you, cynic and fool, it is really, well, you stated it well in terms of a person who will believe, in a sense, there's a wish there. Mm-hmm. And then the cynic is kind of going to say what the fool wants to believe, and maybe you could just unpack how those two work together, and then if there can be some, because as I was reading it, I was thinking I certainly went from, I guess, the fool, or however you said, like, there was a point in my life before I started asking too many questions, too many of those darn questions. where you just, I was raised in a family of very conservative Christian believers for generations of that. And there isn't anything you question outside of that worldview, and you don't even have any other influences, and there's nothing to believe except for what you've been told. And so there isn't any other worldview. That's it. And so you're not thinking you're a fool until you learn something else. And then you're like, what? There's something else, you know? And so you're not unintelligent, but there's just one way to see things. And you are a fool. You are unaware. And then later when you become aware of something else, then you have to decide if you're going to abandon that other thing or if you're going to just go along with it, even though you know better.
Right. Yeah.
And so that, I think, is that a little bit about what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think so. I'm finishing up a doctorate at the moment, but I went to seminary before that, and I kind of noticed that an awful lot of my friends who felt a lot of pressure. I was already long out of wanting to go into a pastoral vocation at that point, but I noticed that a lot of my friends sort of started off on that route and realized that their job prospects, if they wanted to be honest, were a lot smaller than their job prospects if they would just sort of stay vague. Or sort of feign belief in things that you sort of get ruined on your first day of seminary, right? So, and so I have some very good friends that I highly respect and are super intelligent and very honest people who are pastors. But I have just as many who kind of said, well, if I talk about things that you learn on day one of any class, I would never be able to get hired. So if I'm going to do the honest thing, I just need to step off of this route. So I have like a number of personal stories like that in the background. But I think, the whole idea for writing this book came from this one particular example Lacan gives in one of his seminars. And it's like a 2 or 3 page thing that just kind of he throws out there like it's no big deal, but it stayed with me ever since, where he kind of says, basically, the way it works is you've got these leftist fools and these right-wing cynics or knaves, and nobody knows how to talk to each other because nobody realizes their leaders are operating on completely different logics. So he says, you know, you don't have to really wonder why the leftist is arguing for full employment or rights for minorities or healthcare or anything like that. Like there, nobody, even if you disagree with those policies, nobody really looks at somebody saying more access to healthcare or rights for minorities and says, what creepy concealed interest are you working for? You know, like you can say whether you believe that's right or wrong, there's sort of a directness to it, right? Mm-hmm. There's sort of a foolish directness, like we really can just make the world better. You don't really have to think about motives behind the scenes quite so much. Maybe you do more with liberals, but not with like sort of the pure provocative like leftist desire or whatever, right? But then sort of, so Lacan kind of says, on the other hand, the right-wing leader has this tendency to admit when he's a crook, and I think he's saying that before he says that seminar, I think around the same time, but maybe a little bit before Nixon had that famous line about being a crook. But Lacan says, you know, kind of like the right winger will kind of admit that they're a crook when they're pressed. And so I use the example of, you know, you can imagine, and I wrote this example a year before he who shouldn't be named declared his candidacy. I swear I wrote this before, but I wrote this example saying, let's just say that you have like this sort of East Coast elite character who you know went to all the schools, traveled around the world, and now he finds himself campaigning for president in sort of a rural area where community ties are very strong, where faith plays an active role, where graduating seniors from high school tend to stick close to home, where there's a real sense of community ethos. You know, what is that politician going to have to say? He's going to have to say, the problem in society is immigration. The problem is, you know, people stealing jobs. The problem is these East Coast Washington elitists or whatever. He's basically going to describe himself in a way that they won't notice, you know, hopefully. Like, it only works if you sort of don't notice. So let's say that you have, like, a journalist attending, and, you know, he pulls up a chair at the hotel bar afterwards, and he asks the politician, you know, you just kind of got up there and said a lot of things that you can't possibly believe. Like, you're way too educated. You've traveled the world. You know what's going on in the world. Like, do you really think that immigrants are the reason that we're having all these problems? And, you know, in my telling of the story, the politician kind of smiles and sets his papers down and says, don't insult me. Do not call me stupid. Of course I know that that's not the way the world works, but that is what they are paying me to say. Right. Like, so there's a sense in which we can only reward politicians that reflect certain values that we have, that reflection needs to rise to a level that we can ignore everything that we don't like about them. Mm. Right. But for a lot of situations, there's this cynical, like, I'm going to describe myself as the problem and hope my constituents don't notice or something. Or I use the example of, and the same problem sort of on the opposite end affects the left. And you even see this in churches, right? Like, so, you know, perhaps like a more liberal congregation wants to think of themselves as skeptical, but they want a leader who believes directly, right? Like mm-hmm. that really believes this stuff, or who will really stay faithful to the tradition without questioning it, mm-hmm. right? And then congregations that are more on the right wing of the perspective want a leader who will say the party line regardless of what he thinks, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so if you go to seminary, you learn on the first day that we have 5,300 first millennium Greek manuscripts and not one of them match. But if you're going to get a job, you need to pretend like we can talk about inerrancy or know exactly what the Bible said, or, you know, something like that, right? Mm-hmm. So like sort of the institutional logic, the people sort of want a leader that can reflect the inverse of their position. So if you're very anxious about what you believe, you want a leader who can be very strong. Mm-hmm. If you're very flexible about what you believe, you want the leader who can be strong, but in a very different way, right? So, so that's sort of what I'm getting at. My wager is that a lot of the problems that we have with communicating to people have to do with these differences of how we use ideas, what they mean to us, how certain we want to be versus how certain we want our leaders to be. And I think we have a more honest conversation and a more hopeful society if we think through those differences.
It's really a great, like a jolt we need. You talk a lot about anxiety in this one portion. What I read might not even make it into the book, but I hope that it does. If you don't mind, I'd like to read a quote of what pulled out. And it talks about anxiety, and this is you have a lot of gems in here of quotes, and I will not be distributing them, but I thought this was so brilliant, and maybe you can speak to this. And you write, in the beginning, there was only anxiety. It spread because it is a caring mother, and now it is worshipped in the very rituals that were supposed to suppress it. We never really suppress anything. Instead, we repress. We keep it out of sight, but the repressed will always return with brute force. The walls we erected to protect us from anxiety were called rituals, and rituals became religions. And religions became doctrines, and doctrines became exclusion. Exclusion became certainty, and certainty became anxiety. And there's this circling back, and right. You know, anxiety is really at this core of this whole thing. And so it's kind of like what you're talking about as well. This the left wants their anxieties fixed, the right wants their anxieties fixed, and they try to even out that seesaw.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, when I am writing about anxiety, like in that passage, I'm thinking primarily not just about psychoanalysis, but also about the theologian Paul Tillich, who one of the most helpful classes I took during my doctoral studies was this class on Tillich, and he describes anxiety as being sort of the base of every ritual. So a ritual is a way of sort of taking anxiety and organizing it into something that's productive. And so he has different ways of breaking this down. He says anxieties are sort of grouped into ontological, the way things are, the way you live now, but you will die. There's sort of the ontological, and then the moral, and then the spiritual. And he says all of these sort of work on a spectrum, right? So like we feel ontological anxiety relatively at the prospect that we will die, and then absolutely when we actually do, right? And then we feel moral anxiety relatively in the sense that we might be guilty or condemned, and then absolutely when we feel condemnation and cast out by our community. And we feel spiritual anxiety relatively when we question whether our life will be meaningless. And then we feel it absolutely when we decide that our existence is absolutely meaningless and worthless, right? So we have all these sort of different ages of anxiety that sort of trace out in different ways. One thing that he says then is that when you're dealing with anxiety, people develop rituals around it to sort of organize it into something that can be personally meaningful, and then sort of a cohesive to the community. So the Eucharist is a great example, right? Like a Eucharist, people go to Mass and participate in the Eucharist, and it means a lot of different things to everybody that's there, right? To some people, it's just the anxiety. All it's doing is organizing the anxiety that I want some sort of spiritual dimension in life, right? And so it's great to participate in this, right? Sometimes people will take communion when they're participating in some sort of social justice action or whatever, right? Like, so, and then it becomes a symbol of justice. Sometimes people come and take communion when they've just lost their job or a family member or something along those lines, right? And then it means something completely different, right? So you have this one ritual that can mean so many different things, but collectively it's a good way to organize anxiety. So in psychoanalysis, we often say that, I believe this is originally a quote from Freud, but this is a big theme in Lacan. We say that anxiety is the only affect that never lies, right? So I can fake anger or fake happiness. I can fake all sorts of emotional states. I can try to fake anxiety, but that's harder to do, right? And when somebody is clearly displaying anxiety, you know that something's going on, right? Like even if they're just trying to fake it, which rarely happens, but even if they are trying to show any sort of anxiety, like you know something's going on, right? Like their hands are shaking, their voice is quivering. Something is going on in the background that's creating that problem. So anxiety is the only thing that never lies, because anxiety is always telling you that there is a problem, right? If I fake anger, I can be doing that because I want to be self-righteous, right? If I'm anxious, if I'm, you know, quivering, even, you know, slightly anxious just in this interview, right, that I'll misstep or say something I didn't want to say, right? It's because I have a fear that something is going to go awry, right? So anxiety is, in a sense, a place where you feel like you don't know what you're supposed to do. But in another sense, it's the only place where you know anything for sure, namely that you're anxious, that something is not working right, right? So anxiety is very, very important in psychoanalysis because it designates where a problem is. And then people respond to anxiety in different ways. We want to keep anxiety at a distance. We want to resolve anxiety by asking, what does the big other want? Which puts you right back into the logic of being used by a system, right? Anytime you're asking, what does someone else want instead of what do I want, right? Another way we put this in Lacan puts this in one of his seminars, is he says, so we have this idea that anxiety is completely without object, that it's just sort of free floating. And then we also like to think that anxiety causes us, that like we, let's say that we doubt some decision that we made or doubted some belief. And then we start feeling anxious afterwards, right? Like maybe I'm wrong. And Lacan says, no, the relationship is actually the exact opposite. It's not that we doubt and then feel anxiety. It's that we feel anxiety and then we doubt, right? So in a sense, anxiety is where something isn't working and then you start doubting things. You doubt your beliefs, you doubt your relationship, you doubt your job or what, you know, whatever else. But the important thing is that you don't have control. Once anxiety starts kicking in, you can foster doubts or you can try to suppress them, but you don't actually have that much say in what you believe. Like you'd like to think that you can just choose to believe something. But if you do that, the only way you can, let's say you start to doubt some sort of crucial fundamentalist doctrine like we all did like growing up, right? Like think back to the way that you dealt with that. When you first started fearing that you were losing your faith, what you did was you tried to be as ambiguous as possible. You tried to look up apologetic websites that you kind of already know aren't really good arguments or really good evidence, right? You try to talk to people and see what kind of sort of nebulous platitudes they can offer, right? Like you want to keep that anxiety at a distance by being as ambiguous as possible so that you can kind of keep on going doing what you're doing because you think that you have some sort of control over whether you're doubting, but you don't, right? So, I mean, that's an uncontrollable thing, ultimately. So I'm very interested in how anxiety works sort of at the base of religion, at the base of rituals, especially, and to some degree, the beliefs themselves, but especially the rituals. There's always some sort of anxiety that they're covering over. And I'm interested in looking at what that is.
Yeah, it was really fascinating how you were linking up anxiety and ambiguity. And I saw myself in that for sure. And I hadn't thought of it that way, but really we are just kind of like perpetually anxious creatures, I guess, you know, and there isn't really any getting around that. We're trying different coping mechanisms, whether it's mindfulness or whether it's religious practice or something. And we're trying to keep that at bay or make certainty some sort of answer for it. But it's interesting that you point out that certainty creates anxiety, not dissipates it really, because then you end up questioning your certainty and so on. It's not the it's not the answer to anxiety.
Yeah, and I have a quote that I use kind of over and over in different forms throughout the book, where I say that orthodoxy is what you hold on to when you have nothing to say about the doctrine itself. Mm. And you have nothing to say because, like, you don't want to. If you need to be certain, then certainty is the only thing holding your anxiety at bay, and you're only feeling certain because you're still somewhat ambiguous about how all these beliefs fit together, or how these fit with the other philosophical arguments out there or the other sciences out there, right? Mm. Like, you want to keep it, like, so there's a sense in which ambiguity is kind of the best certainty that you can have, right? And so that's why the people who say that they're the most certain, the fundamentalist, is always ambiguous about what they think. You know, you ask, you know, how does this argument work with something else? And they say, well, you know, and then they'll quote some sort of, like, ridiculous apologetic or whatever, you know, to try to convince you that they've thought this through. But it's all about keeping it at a distance, right? Mm. And none of this is, I'm sort of beating up on the fundamentalists here, which I don't think it's a helpful way to view the world overall, but I don't think that I'm past that, right? Like, this mm-hmm. is something that we all do. This is not something you get away from. Mm-hmm. It's just helpful to think about how it works. There's a story that Freud uses, maybe, and then I can shut up, where he says, you know, he uses this joke where Mr. A borrows a kettle from Mr. B, and then Mr. B gives it back to A. And A says, "Oh my God, you gave me the kettle back broken, and it has a hole in the bottom of it." And the guy says, "Well, first off, it doesn't have a hole in it. Second off, it already had a hole in it when I borrowed it from you. And third off, I never borrowed this," right? So, like, you know, and that's the way that we argue a lot of times. Like, they're sort of mutually contradictory, overlapping arguments. Mm. And as long as we sort of scattershot those arguments, we don't seem to notice that they don't work as a whole, right?
We think we have all our bases covered, not realizing it's completely illogical to begin with. And yeah.
The book of Job does this. The book of Job is, like, great example, because, like, if you read the book of Job, mm-hmm. You know, Job loses his family and all his possessions, and his friends come with basically three arguments, mm-hmm. and they're the three arguments people still use today. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Job, you had this coming, you deserve this. Mm-hmm. B, Job, God is trying to teach you something. And then third, Job, others have it worse. They actually use, like, there's poor starving children somewhere, that argument, right? So, like, you deserve this, A. B, it's an opportunity to learn. C, I'm going to negate your suffering by saying others have it worse. Mm-hmm. We still have all these same arguments today. They sort of overlap, and it mm-hmm. doesn't matter if they don't work together mm-hmm. as long as you don't think about how they don't work together.
Yeah. And I've always liked that. I think you might have said this too, that I think, at least how I read Job, is that you aren't really left with any answer. And people want to force an answer onto Job, like, that there actually is one, but I actually think that there isn't one. And I've always thought, well, isn't that interesting? I don't think Job leaves you with an answer unless you're going to force one onto it. Is like, bum, bum, bum. Like, now what? So you have to be okay with that there isn't an answer to Job. But a lot of people are like, sure, there's an answer. God says this. But if you really look at it, it kind of makes no sense.
Yeah, God comes back and kind of has no answer except to say, like, look at the behemoth. You know, there's no answer whatsoever.
It's a puzzle.
I've talked through that a million times with a friend of mine who's a chaplain. This guy Nate, a good friend of mine, he's really good at what he does, and what he kind of talk about is how, like, he's a hospital chaplain, mm-hmm. so he sees the worst things that can happen to mm-hmm. a human body, and mm-hmm. then the way that families try to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And he'll say, you know, like, so obviously, mm-hmm. It's only a very, very rare occasion where the chaplain's role is to insert himself and say, no, maybe this didn't happen for a reason. Maybe if God at the end of Job comes in and says, I have no explanation. I'm so sorry. Like, I have no way of counting for how this happens, right? Mm. You know, like, so usually people really just need to latch on to one particular narrative, and that carries them through, at least for a while. Yeah. Right. But, like, the leader's role is not to step in and correct that.
Mm-hmm. It's just to walk. In my training at seminary, I went through spiritual formation, and you're not supposed to impose. You're supposed to walk with. You're supposed to stand with and walk with. You're not supposed to say, hey, and here's the thing you're supposed to believe, and here's my way of seeing it. You're just supposed to journey with somebody in soul friendship. And that's really the training to be a good friend in any circumstance. And so it's kind of like when I went to my pastors, I was trying to figure out a way we could maybe incorporate this into discipleship. And, it wasn't part of the program really. So I felt like it's not really part of the deal. And so what's interesting is that would actually help people more than learning the doctrine. Like it would actually help people in life. And so it's fascinating, because your anxiety isn't going to go anywhere, but if you at least have other people with you, you're going to feel a lot better, because we are social and we're going to be needing each other the whole time. It's not going to be like suddenly a particular doctrine is going to make that anxiety go away, or a particular story is going to make that go away. So it's like you're going to have to contend with this your whole life in one way or another. And so, I think I was definitely raised on the Jesus pill. Jesus is like this pill, and when you take this pill, you're going to feel better, and Jesus is the answer. And it was like, that did not work.
Sure.
And so it's really interesting, because we are consumers, at least in the United States. And so the consumer thing is really a false promise. And so reading your stuff about anxiety, it's like, guess what? There's still anxiety. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So I think it's good to encounter some of that for what it is, for authentically saying, you're going to have a lot of problems because you have anxiety, because that's like a human thing. And then kind of pushing through all that to see some of the weird things we're doing to compensate for this generalized anxiety that we actually experience.
Yeah.
And so when do you anticipate your book coming out then?
I am sending off the final proofs this is sort of mid-July. So by the deadline is the end of July, and then it kind of depends on their schedule at that point.
Yeah.
I'm hoping by the end of the 2016 or the very first part of 2017, and it'll be coming out with Cascade. Kester Bruin is writing the foreword for that. I'm pretty excited about that. He's been very supportive of me. I know you've had him on. Mm-hmm. I'm excited to get this message out there, and I hope it's helpful to people thinking about how these ideas work. I'm sort of trying to use everything that I found that was helpful, teaching my intro to religion classes to college students, and the ideas that people have sort of cited back as being helpful from previous work. And I'm really hoping this is helpful and gets this material in the vernacular.
Yeah,
getting it out of the academy.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because it can stay, especially like when you think about the journals that you read in graduate school and things like that. It's pretty much four people reading it. Two of them are the people who also wrote in the journal, and it just stays in this tiny, tiny circle. But a lot of those things, especially things that you're talking about, could really be life changing and could really open people's minds to understanding things in a much deeper, more powerful way. So I wish you the best in that. And I think it's very powerful stuff. So you're going to have to keep your eyes open for this, my listeners. I'm going to put links in the show notes for this. And maybe you can also, Tad, maybe you can tell people where they can find you at a website or on the socials, where would be good places.
Yeah, very good. The book will be called The Cynic and the Fool, and that'll be out sometime this year, and I'll announce that on my website. And I have links to my previous book, God is Unconscious, Psychoanalysis and Theology, there too. My website is just taddelay.com, and my Twitter handle is taddelay. Look me up on Facebook or Instagram or wherever else. I'm pretty easy to find, because I think I'm just about the only Tad DeLay. I think there's a couple others, and I've sadly eclipsed them on the first few pages of Google, and I feel bad about that, but I'm pretty easy to find.
Don't feel bad. It's their it's their own fault.
I feel bad about it. Yeah. Yeah, but I'm pretty easy to find looking up on Twitter or website, and I'll be posting updates when I have them about the new book.
Very good. Well, thank you so much. It was really nice to spend some time together, and hopefully we'll have you back on, especially if you continue to be making such interesting material. I'm not going to even ask you about your next book after that. I want it to be a total surprise.
And, that'll be the dissertation. That will intolerably, awfully academic.
Oh, no.
The thing is I want to, I really feel like we as academics have a responsibility to do both. And so, I hope to keep publishing sort of alternating every year to an academic book and a popular level book, and that's a really big important value to me. So
that's wonderful. And then you can continue teaching in LA, you think? Or
yeah, for the foreseeable future. That's been a brand new teacher and really enjoying it, and it hones the way that I write and think, and yeah, it's been a great experience.
Wonderful. This has been really fun. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, well, thank you. It's great talking.
Show notes for this episode can be found at sparkmymuse.com. There you'll find details for websites and people and books mentioned in this episode, and sometimes you'll find photos and videos too.